Hi folks, the fight against cancer continues, and not only can you help, but you can win yourself a very, very cool prize. Here's the deal. Marcus and EJ Strickland, they're twin brothers. Marcus is a saxophone player, EJ is a drummer. They both have just released new CDs, and they are doing a double CD release party at the famed Joe's Pub in New York City this Friday, August 21st. So if you are listening to this show on the day that it is released, which is August 17th, and on that day only, you have until 10 p.m. tonight to make a donation to my Livestrong Cancer Ride. Just go to thejazzsession.com. You'll see all the Livestrong links on the left side. There's a big banner ad and a scrolling list of names. Click on one of those to donate, and for every $5 you donate, you get a raffle ticket. And I will be drawing those prizes tomorrow, Tuesday, the 18th. So, again, the concert is this Friday, the 21st of August, 2009, and you need to donate by 10 p.m. tonight, Monday, August 17th. You'll get two tickets to the show, you'll get two autographed CDs, one from each brother, and you'll get a meet and greet, a chance to hang out with Marcus and EJ at the gig at Joe's Pub this Friday. So remember, donate by 10 p.m. tonight. Now, if you don't win the Strickland Prize, don't worry about it, because your donation will still count toward all the drawings next week, which include tickets for Kenny Barron and Mulgrew Miller, Dave Brubeck, autographed CDs, LPs, all kinds of cool stuff. So, for the Strickland Prize, it's donate by tonight, Monday the 17th at 10 p.m. Eastern Time, I should say. And for everything else, just get your donations in by this Friday, okay? Thank you. Thank you for your help in fighting cancer. I am so close to my goal that it is easily visible from where I sit here in my house in Albany. And now, on with the show.
Lesson 1. Basic Hip.
Welcome to The Jazz Session, the weekly jazz interview show. I'm Jason Crane. The Jazz Session is presented by AllAboutJazz.com, the web's leading source for jazz news, reviews, MP3 downloads, and more. The Jazz Session is also available at TheJazzSession.com and in iTunes. This week's guest is Hammond B3 organist Gene Ludwig. From his album Hands On, here's Louie and Jazz.
Thank you.
My guest is Hammond B3 organist Gene Ludwig. He's had quite a storied career performing with many jazz greats, and we'll get to that. But first, Gene, thanks so much for being here and taking some time to appear on the Jazz Session.
Well, thanks for having me.
It's a real pleasure. You are, I think I really became familiar with you kind of in the modern era with the album that you recorded with Red Holloway and Plas Johnson, which I remember playing the heck out of, and really enjoying, and seeing your name on there caused me to say, I need to find more Gene Ludwig. And there is more out there going all the way back to the 60s and an affiliation with another saxophonist who just about everybody knows, named Sonny Stitt. Can you talk about how you first met Sonny?
Well, Sonny was working with Don Patterson and Billy James. Don was another excellent organist, and of course Billy James, the drummer. And I had heard Sonny on the air for years before I joined him, you know, and I became a fan of his, you know. And when John, Don, and Billy left the trio, I was working with a drummer who lives in Lansing, Michigan now, Randy Gillespie. He got wind that Sonny was looking for a rhythm section, and he called me and said, would you be interested in working with Sonny? I said, sure. So he called Sonny, and we hooked up. I think our first job was at Paul's Mall, the Jazz Workshop in Boston, Massachusetts, and that was, I think, November of 69.
So, Gene, was there an audition, or did you just, you guys hooked up on the gig and decided to see how it went?
No, it was a done deal. We hooked up, and the second job we went to was at a place called the Club Baron in New York City, and we worked opposite Cannonball Adderley for 2 weeks, and that was the biggest thrill of my life.
That must have been amazing. Can just talk a little bit more about that experience. What was that scene like? What were those rooms like that you were playing in those days?
Well, they were more or less lounges, you know, and the seating capacity, I would say, maybe 200 people. And we were there in those days. We were there like six nights a week, seven nights a week, and that was the going thing during the 60s and the 50s and 60s. It was all six and seven nights a week at the same place. Sometimes we get 2 weeks, and then we move on to the next town.
And was that multiple shows a night sometimes?
Oh, we had sets. Like my first time I encountered New York City was in 1962, and we worked 10:20 till 4 o'clock. So it was
10:20 p.m. till 4 o'clock a.m. Right?
Right. We did six sets, and usually on the on the club circuit, it was all sets. We'd work 9 or 2, and maybe 10 till 3, but it was all we do like. Maybe an hour set, take a half hour off. We do about 4 or 5 sets a night.
Now, what kind of people, Gene, would you get out for a gig at 3 o'clock in the morning?
Well, I was amazed in New York City because, you know, being from Pittsburgh, I was used to getting off at 2 and having them roll up the sidewalk, so to speak, at 2 o'clock in the morning. But when I hit New York and we were playing at 3 o'clock and 3:30 in the morning and people were still coming in off the street partying, and it's just like it was 9 o'clock at night. And I thought to myself, this is amazing, you know. But New York is New York, as they say.
What was Sonny Stitt like to work with?
Oh, he was wonderful. He was one of my mentors, you know. I learned a lot of music from Sonny, and a lot about the business also. And he was sort of notorious for being hard to work with back in those days, but I found it very, very relaxing working with him. And like I said, it was quite an education for me.
Now, I do want to talk about the present, but before we do that, I want to mine the past a little bit more, just to make sure that folks know, you know, kind of where you came from and how you came up. Can you talk about the first time that you heard or saw a Hammond B3 organ jazz performance, and mm-hmm. what impact it had on you?
Well, the first time I heard organ was in the radio back before television in the late 40s. They had a sitcom called Beulah. It was a sitcom about a housekeeper, and there was a swing organist they used as a pad on that show. It came on once a week, and I fell in love with the sound of the organ then, you know, and that was around 1948. And
And it seems like just about every old-time radio show, I mean, everything from The Shadow to all the little family comedies had an organ player as the only accompaniment half the time, right?
Right. A friend of mine just interviewed, I don't know if she's still living, but she was the original organist on The Shadow, and he interviewed her down in Florida. She was 95 years old.
Are you kidding?
That's right.
So, I'm sorry, I interrupted you. So you first heard organ on the radio, and then what happened
then
next?
When I came into high school, you know, like Bill Dogg was very popular. You know, he came out with Honky Tonk, you know, and I really fell in love with the sound of the organ then. And I had heard Bill Davis and Milt Buckner. And when I first heard Jimmy Smith play in 57, it was he was doing organ more like playing like a pianistic sound, you know, with a single line where all the other guys were soloing with the block chords. And Jimmy, he's so fluid with his playing that I thought to myself, this is amazing. That's really turned me around, you know. And that's when I said, well, that's what I want. And subsequently, I bought my first Hammond in 1958.
Your first, correct me if I'm wrong, but your first Hammond was not a B3, right? Is that right?
It was an M100, a small organ. You know, that's the only thing that I could afford. You know, I think I paid $800, but I played that for about a year. And then I graduated, so to speak, to a larger organ. I got a church model, or C3, you know, and I've been playing Hammond equipment ever since, well over 50 years now.
Now, I used to own a C3. And I once had to move it up two flights of stairs in a warehouse where it was being stored. And I got to say, that one experience of moving it was all the organ moving experience I'll ever need. And you have been carrying an organ around to gigs for, we're coming up on 60 years now, it seems like.
You know, I started my moving career, I think, around 58 or 58 when I first bought my first organ. But they have what they call rolling carries now. It's a device that you put around, strap around the organ, and you can lift it up on wheels, and you can wheel that thing. Matter of fact, I had a gig in New York where I wheeled the organ up in the middle of Broadway because there was no room on the sidewalk. So I was out in the middle of Broadway wheeling an organ up to the gig.
Listen, that thing may be on wheels, but they still weigh a ton.
Absolutely. 450 pounds.
Yeah, that's not a piccolo that you're wheeling there, my friend.
That's right.
You saw Jimmy Smith, you decided, okay, this is what I want to do, and at that time, had you had already designs on a career as a professional musician?
Well, not really. My mother wanted me to be a concert pianist, but unfortunately, I got the rhythm and blues bug when I came out of high school, you know, and I went on to college, but I majored in physical science and minored in mathematics. I was going to be a physics teacher and minored in math. And I came out of college after 2 years, you know, and I was playing on the weekends, you know, whatever I could get on piano, you know, before I started on organ. And I had enough college that I got into civil engineering. And I worked on a building here in Pittsburgh. I was on that for 14 months as a civil engineer. And that finished up in 1959. So one morning after the job finished up, they, of course, laid me off. I decided I wanted to, give the music thing a shot, you know. And I flipped a coin, and this actually happened. I flipped a coin, you know, and it said, heads, I'll go, pursue an engineering thing, you know, and or tails, I'll be a musician. It came down tails, and that's the way it's been for, well, I've made my complete living, you know, with this playing for 50 years now. It'll be 50 years in November.
Now, in the early 60s, when you were really striking out on your own as a musician, there were actually kind of Hammond organ rooms, right? I mean, clubs that kind of specialized in that music, is that right?
Well, most musicians, organ players, they carried their own instrument, you know, because everybody has a set that's different. I sat down to different organs, and they don't seem any different to me, but a lot of people were just, you know, they were more or less persnickety about, you know, having their own instrument. But all the rooms that I played, you know, like the Key Club, the Hurricane, you know, they were all acclimated to the organ sound. So, yes, that was the thing of the day. That was the instrument of the day.
And you would often, you had fairly long runs every year in some of the same clubs, right? Where you'd play for 6 weeks, 8 weeks in the same place, coming back year after year, is that the case?
Well, the first long run we did was in Atlantic City in 1962. I was working out of an agency out of New York, Queen Booking, and Ruth Bone, who was the president, she booked us into Atlantic City for a weekend. And it was Mother's Day of 63. And we opened with Dizzy Gillespie and James Moody and Kenny Barron and Chris White. I think Rudy Collins was in that band. And the management, the owner, liked us so much, he kept us all summer. So subsequently, I had a chance to work that whole year up until the Miss America pageant, that whole summer. I had a chance to work with like Ahmad Jamal, Ramsey Lewis, Jack McDuff, Jimmy McGriff, who else? Oh, there was quite a few in there that summer.
I mean, for an organ fan and a guy really only a few years into a professional career, that must have been kind of like a kid in a candy store time, wasn't it?
Oh, absolutely. I was just getting started. Although I had recorded, you know, a couple things in, you know, and I always surrounded myself with the best cast that I could get, you know, like Randy Gillespie and Jerry Bird. That was our trio. And we had a wonderful trio. So everywhere we went, the people, we just grew on the people, and they liked us. So we were very fortunate that way.
Now, you've talked about the meeting with Sonny Stitt and then going on to perform with Sonny. The next kind of big meeting that you had with a name that everybody will recognize was with Arthur Prysock. Is that correct?
Right. I ran into Arthur. I was working with, matter of fact, 1960. I hadn't even formed my group yet. I joined a band. That's where I met Randy Gillespie. There was Gene Barr and Jimmy Landers, tenor saxophone and guitarist. We had an R&B group, and we got booked into a club in, where was it, Canton, Ohio. Arthur had just come out with, he had recorded with a buddy, Buddy Johnson band, and he was doing a single then. It wasn't even carrier band, so he came into the club, and we worked a weekend together, and that was around 1960. And from that day on, we kept in contact, you know, and I think it was like 13, 14 years later, that he was changing up his band. He came through Pittsburgh and he says, "Are you interested in traveling?" And I said, "Sure." He said, "Well, come on, to New York." And he says, "Well, you can join us in New York." So I think the Five Spot was the very first job that I did with Arthur, and that was in '73. Thank you.
Around the 70s, what was the scene like for a Hammond organ player? Was it as hot as it had been in the 60s?
Not quite. You know, things were, I don't know, were mellowing, mellowing out, but everything was going to the towards a rock thing, you know, and a lot of clubs were changing over to rock and roll, and even the rhythm and blues thing was taking a kick. So the organ rooms from the 10 years before that, they were just drying up.
So what did that mean for you as a player? What did you have to do to make ends meet if there were fewer places that catered to the kind of music you were used to playing?
That's one of the reasons I joined Arthur, because, you know, like, he was working steady, you know, and had a chance to see a lot more of the country than I had previously, and it was wonderful. We worked Chicago, you know, and we worked Los Angeles, San Francisco, Texas, all over the country with Arthur, you know. And I left that band and came back home, and that's when I got into the lounge circuit with the Ramadas and the Holiday Inns, you know. But they were all working six nights a week, and I did that for quite a few years.
Now, at some point, you, although you of course started on piano, you started working piano back into your repertoire. Is that right?
Yeah, around 1980, 81, you know, like, the call for the organ was getting, you know, far and few between, so I decided, you know, like, I got a call from a few bass players wanting to know if I had, you know, if I was into piano as much as I was organist, playing the aggressive, you know, and I said, well, you listen, tell me what you think, you know, and I went on a couple jobs, and they said, oh, yeah, man, he says, You play very aggressively, you know, and that really got me started with the working with bass players.
Do you play your own bass when you play the organ, Gene?
Right. I have a technique where I've worked out between the pedals and the left hand, and it's worked for me all these years.
Now, we should say, for anybody who is not familiar with the Hammond organ, that it has two keyboards, and then it also has a set of pedals that you can play with your feet that play bass notes. And some organ players, even some of the most famous ones, didn't play bass. They had bass players in their band, and they would just play with their hands. Now, did you always from the beginning incorporate the pedals in?
All the time. I never, even till today, if a bass player comes on the job and I'm playing organ, I'm sorry, you know, like I'll lay out, if you want to play, if I have a guitar player, I'll let if it's going to be a jam session, I'll let the guitar player play with the bass, you know, and I'll just lay out, because it clashes so much. See, the two of those instruments are very deep, you know, the organ has a very deep timbre to it, you know, and so does the bass, so it clashes.
I've interviewed a bunch of organists over the years, and it still always amazes me that you are effectively an entire band in your own limbs. I mean, you have your feet are carrying the bass line, your left hand much of the time is comping or playing chords, you're improvising in your right hand. How is it possible to keep all that straight in your brain at one time?
You become a machine. Well, you know, it's like playing drums. You know, I look at the drummer playing, you know, and he's using like a cymbal ride with his right hand, you know, and he's playing paradiddles or what have you with his left hand, a snare drum. And then he's got the sock going all the time on 2 and 4, and then he's exiting with his bass pedal, you know, and that's got all it. That's the same thing with an organist, you know, like you have the right foot for the expression, left foot for the bass, and left hand, where you can carry the left, give your leg a rest and carry the bass line with your hand, or you can chord with your left, and of course you got your melody and everything, comping and everything with your right hand.
Yeah, sure, it sounds easy. I mean, the you know, the thing that, not to take anything away from the skill that it takes to play the drum set well, but the difference is that the drummer can't really play a wrong note, whereas you have to keep, you're keeping bass, harmony, and melody, and melodic improvisation all together at one time.
You're forgetting about time, too.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah, you've got the time to take care of, too, so you've got your plate is full.
So how important is the drummer to that whole setup?
Well, the drummer has to be a good pocket drummer to play with an organist. I've worked with a few drummers, you know, that were they either play behind the beat or on top of the beat, and it's very hard to pocket with them. But for the most part, the drummers that I've been fortunate to work with, you know, they like the sound of the organ, they like the groove of the feeling, so they fall right in there, and it's been quite an experience, you know. And for the most part, everybody's been excellent.
What was it about Randy Gillespie that made him special in the beginning?
Well, Randy's an all-around drummer. When I first heard him play, like, 1959, 60, when we locked up, he was cooking then, you know. He's playing, you know, his timing was great, you know, and he's one of the heaviest swingers I've ever worked with, you know. And when I say swing, you know, I put him in the same category as like Max or Art Blakey. Those guys were heavy hitters as far as swing goes, you know. And Randy, that's the first thing that really impressed me, the way he swung, you know, and made me swing. So, you know, we just locked it in.
From my vantage point, the jazz organ has undergone a real resurgence in the last maybe 10 years or so. Does it look the same from where you're sitting?
Well, yeah, since 1990, you know, like it had a resurgence due to some of the younger organists coming out with records, you know, and getting a lot of airplay. And since then, there's quite a few youngsters coming out today, and some of them are quite good.
Do you feel like you're kind of getting a second bite at the apple in terms of being able to play more, to record more, like you're getting a chance to do kind of the thing that you excel at again after having to, you know, just cobble together whatever gigs there were in the days when the organ wasn't as popular?
Let's see. I think I recorded in 1980. That was for Joe Phil's on Muse, and I hadn't recorded for 18 years. And I did an album, and I shopped it around, and finally Looseleaf picked it up. That was in 1998, and I've done six projects for them in the last 10 years. I still get a kick out of recording, although it can be very, it's hard on me anymore because I'm not getting any younger. So I think recording-wise, you know, I just try to pace myself and maybe do maybe an album a year instead of before I was like doing two or three and putting them in the can.
Listen, you remembered the date of your first gig in Atlantic City. I'm not exactly sure what I had for breakfast this morning.
I'll tell you exactly when it was. It was Mother's Day weekend. We had to do some research on this. 1963, when was Mother's Day? It was the first week of May, and because we were there, we opened Friday, we played Saturday, and Mother's Day was on Sunday. So, and Dizzy, we worked opposite Dizzy for those 3 days.
Now, when you say worked opposite a band, what does that mean exactly?
Well, we were in a club where we'd play an hour, and then we'd have an hour off, and the other group would come on and play an hour, and there was we'd do two sets apiece a night, and then on the weekends, like if they were there all week, and we had what they call breakfast shows, we would do three sets a night, and sometimes I didn't get out of the club until 5 o'clock in the morning.
And then what was the deal with the patrons? Did they have to pay admission for each of the different acts, or how did that work for folks who
no,
were there
they paid
the music?
Kind
of a cover charge?
One cover charge. They could stay there all night, you know. And there was two rooms right up the street. Pop Williams had the Club Harlem, and he was bringing in the bigger acts like Sammy Davis, you know. And I saw Sam Cooke up there, and he had two bands, Chris Colombo and Willis Jackson. they alternated in the front bars. They had two bars in the front, so two stages in the front. So they would alternate, and I can't remember the club on the other side of the street. That's where I met Bill Davis. And when I met Bill, that was 1962 when I was working there, I asked him if he had done the radio things that when I grew up, you know. He said, no, that was Buddy Cole. And I said, well, I'm a big fan of his now. And over the years, I had a chance to hear Buddy play on the air, you know, some records. And he was a fantastic player, too.
Is there kind of a... I can't think of a word other than fraternity, which is unfair because there are well-known women who play the organ too, but is there kind of a family of organ players? Are organ players, do you stay in contact with other organ players and you guys trade ideas and tricks and experiences and that kind of thing?
On the contrary, I got to say this, you know, I found out during my whole career that is one instrument that everybody tries to hide what they're doing, you know, and there's so much, I'm going to say it like it is, there's so much petty jealousy between the players out there. It always has been, you know, that, I can do this and you can't, you know, this and that, you know, and they'll show off, you know, and they play 1,000 notes, you know, and then somebody will come up there and play one note and make it swing, you know. But as a fraternity, no, I can't say that there is a fraternity.
So it's more akin to the guy covering the valves on his trumpet with a handkerchief so no one can see what finger he's using.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. But, you know, like, I can sit down and listen to an organist or a pianist, you know, and if I hear the record enough, you know, like, I can really, you know, more or less copy or understand what they're doing. I talked to John Coltrane years ago, and he says, well, if you can hear it, you can play it. So he's quite right there, or he was quite right.
Did you ever play opposite his band, Gene?
No, never played opposite John. You know, and I think my style of playing. Well, I don't know. That would have to be seen. You know, I don't know if the type of music that he was playing. You know, I mean, he was so far advanced that. I don't think that we could hold a candle to him, you know. But I would have given it a shot if I would ever had a chance, you know.
Is it still fun for you to play this music, even all these years and all these gigs and all these road trips later?
Oh yes, I was at a jam session last night. Matter of fact, there's a fellow and on the other side of town. He has a Wednesday night get together and has a wonderful Yamaha piano out there and. We had two bass players, three tenor saxophones, two drummers, a guitarist, and I was out there for a couple of hours last night, you know, and it's a labor of love because, unfortunately, with the jazz scene today, especially here in Pittsburgh, there's hardly any place to work, you know, and you got to play. You can sit down and practice by yourself for hours and hours, but it's not the same thing as sitting in with a band, you know, and listening to another guy playing or a woman play. You know, and it's just phenomenal.
Well, Gene Ludwig, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you, and I really thank you for sharing your stories and your music with us, and I thank you for being here on the Jazz Session.
Well, thank you, Jason. Thank you.
That was organist Gene Ludwig from his album Hands On. You've been listening to The Jazz Session, the weekly jazz interview show. I'm Jason Crane. The Jazz Session is presented by allaboutjazz.com, the web's leading source for jazz news, reviews, MP3 downloads, and more. Every episode of The Jazz Session is also available for free at thejazzsession.com and in iTunes. The Jazz Session has an email mailing list, which is a great way to win free music. You can sign up at thejazzsession.com. And if you're on Facebook, there's a group there for The Jazz Session, and I give away music at that group, too. The theme music for this show is by The Respect Sextet, their most recent album, Serious Respect, and many others online at respectsextet.com. Thanks also to Dave Rabel, who designed all of the various logos for all of the various iterations of The Jazz Session. Thank you so much for listening. Please support live jazz whenever and wherever you can, and come back next time for another conversation about jazz on The Jazz Session.
Thank you for listening. Bye.